Turn with me, please, to the book of James, Epistle of James to the scattered tribes. I'd like to read the first four verses, though we probably won't cover more than one. We want to look at the introductory things. And the introductory things are not going to be as scintillating. And I gave you a whole four pages. I thought I was back in class somewhere. I think that it would be helpful with all the facts and so forth. You might want to have them at your fingertips and maybe make a few notes along the way. But James chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. James, a bondservant of God and of Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad, greetings. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. I was having dinner, Melanie and I were having dinner with a couple Friday night, former students. I mentioned, it came up, what are you going to be teaching? And I said, well, I'm going to start James on Sunday. He said, well, that's just right, because then maybe the next Sunday you can preach on the tongue for Mother's Day. And I said, what? His wife apparently didn't hear, and I don't know whether Melanie did or not. They were going this way, and we were going this way. But nobody said anything. I said, no, I won't be able to get to chapter 3 for another, maybe next Mother's Day I'll be there. And now that is not what we had in mind at all. We want to talk a little bit about this book. This is a very practical book, as we'll see. Not theology in here, no doctrines. In fact, I was trying to think, in all of my study and teaching of theology, did I ever reference the book of James? Did I ever say, and you'll find that in James chapter whatever. Very few times do we find doctrinal references to the book of James. It's a very practical book. It's a book on how to live. We'll see that in a little bit. We want to look, first of all, though, at the author. The author is James. You say, well, that narrows it down. Yeah, it narrows it down to about four, maybe five different Jameses that we find in Scripture. We know this about him, that he has a pastor's heart. He is a pastor, as we're going to see. He has a pastor's heart. He knows what people are going through. He's concerned about what they're going through. So he has that kind of heart for the people. And he's also, apparently, because of what we see here, probably a very powerful preacher there in Jerusalem. He has a great grasp of the Christian life. You know, that isn't always the case. People don't know very often about the Christian life, how to do it, how to get the Christian life off the ground. Well, this book does it, and we're going to try to bring it together for all of us. So his name is James, one of four in the New Testament, and maybe five if you consider another one. So he's not the father of Judas. This is not Iscariot. There's one, the father of Judas. That's all we know about him. He's mentioned in Luke 6:16, also in Acts 1:13. So he's not the one, apparently. It would probably be somebody a little better known to write a book that winds up in the Bible. The son of Alphaeus is one, another James, in Matthew 10:3 and Acts 1:13. He may be the same as the James the Less, as we find in 1:13. Then there's the apostle, the son of Zebedee. He's John's brother. Remember James and John. That's another James, and I don't think it's him either. He died very early, not too early, because my understanding of this book is that it's very early. But James died about that time. So I don't think it's the Apostle James. So I think, rather, it's the half-brother of Jesus, probably the next in age, because whenever they're mentioned, James, Simon, Jude, and Joseph, James is always listed first, and so probably the oldest next to Jesus, Jesus' next younger brother. And the evidence for that is he spoke very authoritatively in the book and in Acts chapter 15. Now, I want to turn to that a little later, but not at this point. We'll talk about that in a little bit, how authoritatively he taught. But he did speak very authoritative, and there he's very the same way. So the evidence for it is that. And then also on page 2, maybe not that far with you, the high moral standards, a very holy man. He prayed much. In fact, he's one of the New Testament early historians said that they called him camel knees because he's on his knees so much that they actually had calluses on them. And I checked mine, no calluses. I get down on the where there's carpet, you know, that kind of thing. But James, camel knees. He lived in Palestine, and this writer does as well, obviously. You see a lot of indications of that as we go through. And the Greek resembles the letter that James wrote in Acts 15. We'll get to that in a minute. But he wrote it, apparently dictated a letter there, and the Greek in James is very close to the Greek in Acts 15. He was a Nazarite, according to historians. Now, a Nazarite would drink no wine, no strong drink, no razor on his head. You know, that's a sign of humility, a sign of dedication. Now, not everybody has to do that, but when a person does that, normally, it's a sign of a great dedication to the Lord. And then another thing we find here is that the content of this book resembles the Sermon on the Mount. If you have, and if you don't have it, get it, the book Bible Knowledge Commentaries. There are two of them, one for the Old Testament, one for the New. Bible Knowledge Commentary is an excellent commentary, mostly Dallas men, I think all Dallas men. The one who writes in James is Ron Blue, a classmate of mine. He does a good job with both the comparison of the letter and the book of James and the Sermon on the Mount in James. I have a list of a few. I'm not going to bore you with it. In chapter 2, verse 13, in 3:12, 3:18, 5:2, and 5:12. Those are just part of the list that you'll find there in the Bible Knowledge Commentary. And while I'm thinking about commentaries, here's the best, by Zane Hodges. Excellent book, very inexpensive, as all of his books are. This one, I think, is $6.50. He really has it straight on the, I think, on the understanding of the book of James. So Zane Hodges is his name. Now, that brings us to this question. I said he's half-brother of Jesus, and so I thought, well, maybe we ought to discuss whether Mary had other children. You might say, well, oh, of course not. Of course she did. But it's not quite that simple for this reason. Here are some observations why she may not have had other children. There's no statement to that effect. I read that and I thought, I'm reading out of, it was Lenski who gave a whole thing about that, and I thought, oh, of course. He said, no, there's no place in the New Testament that says that Mary had other children. Interesting. When they talk about Jesus' brothers and sisters, but it never says Mary's children. That struck me a little bit. And also that Jesus on the cross committed his mother to Apostle John. You know? Not to James or Jude or Simon or Joseph, you know, her sons, but to his apostle. Now, I think I have a little understanding of that because James was not a believer. In fact, none of his brothers, Jesus' brothers, were believers at the time of the crucifixion. Remember they came to the place where Jesus was and they said, he's beside himself, his mother and brothers. And all came and said, he's beside himself, let's take him away. He thinks he's Messiah. He's got a Messiah complex. He thinks he's the Christ. And they said, well, take him away. They said, your mother and your brothers are outside. He said, look around you. The ones who do the will of my Father, these are my mother and my brothers. And so that seems to me is a little explanation as to why he committed his mother to one of his new brothers and not one of his physical brothers. So on the negative side, though, she did not have children. Those two things are interesting. But on the positive side, there are those called his brothers and his sisters in Matthew 13, 55. And some say, well, these are Joseph's children by a former marriage. That doesn't seem to fit the word brother. In the Greek text, it's adelphos, and that means brother. Some say, well, it's Mary's children, Mary's widowed sister. Mary's widowed sister lived with them, and she had children. And so they were like brothers. Well, it doesn't say like brothers, it said brothers. Brother means brother. That's all it means. So that would seem to me, even though it doesn't say Mary had children, it does say Jesus had brothers, and that's saying the same thing. And then in Matthew 1:25, it says Joseph did not know her until Jesus was born. Now, the until is certainly an assumption that after that he did know her. So she was not a perpetual virgin. That's a myth and contrary to the Bible. Okay. So I take it then he is Jesus' brother, half-brother, father of his father's same same mother, a different father. Now, the history of him, of James. He knew Jesus intimately from birth. Can you imagine having Jesus as your older brother? I love my older brother. He and I were close, closer than any of my other siblings. He was shorter than I. Always short guy. My mother was very short. She was about four feet 11 or something. And he took after her. I took after my father, who was a little taller. But he was my bigger brother. And I imagine having Jesus as a big brother. Didn't do anything wrong. He didn't tease you. Yeah, I expect he had a sense of humor and, you know, jokes and so forth. And that may be, but never anything that would hurt you. What a guy! And can you imagine that they sat around sometimes and Jesus say, "Have you noticed how these vines they fall to the ground here? Have you noticed the sparrows? God takes care of the sparrows." I think he said some of that. As they walked along, you know, why wouldn't he? Say, my big brother said some pretty profound things, and he was a scoundrel at times. Well, all I'm saying is that he knew him well. He knew Jesus well. At one time, he thought Jesus was mentally unbalanced, as we mentioned. He didn't believe on Jesus, and that's an interesting thing. And maybe because of what Jesus said in a man's hometown, he's not accepted. And maybe in your family you're not accepted. Oh, my brother, the Messiah, that may be the attitude. But he was not believing before Jesus' resurrection, John 7, verse 5. And then he received a special appearance by the resurrected Jesus and a special mention by Paul. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul talks about all the people that saw Jesus. He mentions it, he says it this way. He was buried, and he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and he appeared to Peter and to the 12, and after that he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until this day, but some have died by 55 AD. And then he says, verse 7, then he appeared to James and then to all the apostles. James, not an apostle, but he appeared to James. So he has a special appearance by the Lord. Then we find him in the upper room with the disciples and the women. Mary and mother of Jesus was there in Acts 1:14. So he is finally a believer and very dedicated, apparently, as we see him. And then we find him as the head of the church. He was the head of the church in Jerusalem. Now, we'll go to Acts 15. Remember that Paul went around preaching to the Gentiles, and he preached to the Gentiles that in order to be saved, all you had to do was what? Believe. Exactly, believe. And some people got a little bit upset about that. First of all, you're going to the Gentiles, and number two, you're not asking the Gentiles to keep the law. Okay, so they had a meeting about this. Paul went down to Jerusalem, and they had a discussion. They came together, verse 6 of Acts 15 says, the apostles and the elders came together to look into the matter. And after there had been much debate, Peter stood up. He said, brethren, da-da-da-da-da, I opened the door to the Gentiles. And then Paul, verse 12, Barnabas and Paul, they listened to them. And then, verse 13, James answered and said, brethren, listen to me. Simon has related about what God has done and gives a summary of what had been said. Then look at verse 19, Acts 15, 19. Therefore, it is my judgment Whoa. The first pope is there. And James is saying, it's my judgment. Right? This is what I decided. So James is in charge here. So he's giving the verdict and saying, my judgment is this. And then he writes a letter. And apparently, a letter is written. Verse 23 says, they sent a letter by Silas and others to the Gentile churches. And it says, here's what you ought to do. So again, very, very authoritative, very binding letter that was sent to all the churches, apparently over James' signature. And then in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 12, Paul relates a little problem he had with Peter. And that problem resulted in Paul standing Peter to the face and saying, you are wrong. Because he says, and I'll summarize it for you, he says when Peter came up to Antioch he came and ate, and we all ate at one common table, Jews and Gentiles sitting together. But then he says, when some came from James, this is 2:12, but prior to the coming of certain men from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, these men from James, he began to withdraw and hold himself aloof, fearing the party of the circumcision. He wouldn't eat with them. They ate all to side. And it was so strong, this temptation was, that they even took Barnabas. Barnabas was swept away with it, and Barnabas was eating over at the kosher table while the Gentiles ate over here, not eating with the Gentiles. Now, my whole point in this is this. He says, when certain people came from James, they came from Jerusalem, from the home church, but he says they came from James, meaning, I guess James is the head of the church, and so he is saying they came from James. So, again, James is the head of the church. Later on, he asked Paul to go into the temple and go with some men who had a vow and to pay their charges. This was not good advice. James wasn't perfect. And I think that was a mistake for Paul to do that, but he did it to keep peace among the church people. But we talked about that when we were going through the book of Acts. Now, so that's who it is. It's James, the brother of the Lord, head of the church at Jerusalem, and he's the one who's writing this book. And then the time of the writing. This is the earliest book in the New Testament. It was written before anything else was written. I'm sure of that. How early is up for debate? I think maybe as early as the late 30s. Remember, Jesus was crucified in 32. And I think maybe before 40, James was written. Some people put it as far as 40, 45, even 50 in the 50s. I think much earlier. I think very early, not past 40 or 45. That means then, that he's not writing to answer Paul about justification by faith. In fact, he's not writing about justification at all, as we'll see. There's no argument between Paul and James. They are on the same page as far as salvation goes. Now, the book itself. It's a practical book, not doctrinal, as we mentioned. Like Paul. Remember, Paul had some doctrinal books. Romans. Galatians. Of course, Romans did have a, from 12 to 16 is very practical, but is a very doctrinal book. And in Galatians, of course, he's treating a doctrinal problem, and so he's doing that. But mostly Paul's books are a practical section and then a doctrinal section, then a practical section. Ephesians, three chapters. Colossians, 2 and 2. That kind of thing. But this one he's not trying to teach anything. He's simply trying to say, here's how you live the Christian life. It's also very good Greek. I meant to say this. For this reason, many people don't get into the book of James. Number one, it's very hard. A lot of things in there, how in the world do you understand that? You can't grasp an outline. The thing is, it's like a grabbing up a handful of Jell-O that runs all over. Well, but some people have come with a really good outline, as we'll talk about in a little bit. A lot of people, they wanted the doctrine. You know, we used to do this in seminary. Well, I do it now. I love to talk doctrine. So it's a lot easier to talk about that. Oh, Paul says in Romans, you go right through Romans, you know, that kind of thing. And it's exciting to do that. In fact, Luther loved Romans. He said, Romans is a great thing. In fact, it was Romans, reading of Romans, that brought Luther to the position of faith alone in Christ alone. He liked Romans. But guess what he said about James? It's an epistle of straw. I don't like that. And in fact, he wouldn't accept it as in the canon. Luther did not like the book of James. For the reason that he was looking for doctrine, and there wasn't a lot of doctrine there. And I think a lot of people ignore the book of James because it's very convicting. It's a convicting book because here's how the Christian life ought to be lived. Oops, I'm not doing that, you know, and I don't think I want to do that. Well, that would cause people to shy away from the book of James. And one more note, it's very good Greek. This book, James, is very much like the book of Hebrews, very good Greek. Like the first four verses of Luke, very high quality classical Greek in that first four verses of Luke. So James knows a little bit of Greek. He's not a dummy. So, now, the purpose of the book. Well, after the stoning of Stephen in Acts 7, the Christians were scattered out of Jerusalem. We read that in Acts 8:1, that they went throughout Judea and Samaria preaching, but only to the Jews. So it's a very Jewish church even then. And then they went farther, speaking the word, Acts 11:19 says, but again, speaking the word only to the Jews. And so the Jews then are the first readers of this letter, these people who have been scattered abroad, who have witnessed to people, but only to Jews. So it's a very Jewish church that he writes to. And that's one of my reasons for thinking that it's very early, because it's the Gentiles came in, you know, when Paul went on his first missionary journey, and then they went to Antioch, and Antioch was where there were many Jews, and that's where they were first called Christians. But this book is going to these Jewish people. And they were in trials and temptations. Chapter 1 addresses that. They had quarrels and disputes. 4:1. They needed perseverance in all of these things. And chapter 5, verses 7 and 8 and verse 10 talk about that. They needed peace in all the trials. Chapter 5, verse 4. As I said before, it's hard to outline. But somebody has turned to one verse as a good outline, and this happens often in epistles, that you find one verse that tells you, oh, this is how it falls out. Acts 1:8 is a good one. You shall be witnesses to me, both in Jerusalem, Judea and Samaria, the uttermost part of the earth, and that pretty well divides up the book. In the book of Revelation, the things that are, the things you have seen, the things which are, and the things which shall be. That divides the book of Revelation. Well, this verse 19, chapter 1, verse 19, is a good outline, I think, as well. It won't do for me to be in 1 Peter. 1:19. For this you know, my beloved brethren, everyone must be, here it is, quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. Good outline. Swift to hear, basically chapter 2. The first chapter 1 is prologue. Chapter 2 is swift to hear. Chapter 3, slow to speak. And chapter 4, slow to wrath. And then, 4 through 5, 6. And then the epilogue is chapter 5, 7 to 20. So you have, that's basically it. Be swift to hear. Listen. Charles Stanley, listen. Well, we need to listen. And then we also need to be slow to speak. You know, be, you know, God gave us two ears and one mouth. To tell you something? Listen twice, speak once. Well, swift to hear, slow to speak, and then slow to wrath. Just not jumping off the handle at things, being patient. So, good outline. I mentioned also Bible Knowledge Commentary. That's a good, has a good outline in there as well. Ron Blue, good man. So, we come to chapter 1, verse 1. Finally getting to the text. James, the bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad, greeting. Now, first of all, James, we know who he is. James is the writer, the half-brother of the Lord. But notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, and I'm Jesus' brother. Oh, no. Too humble for that. Not going to trade on his brother's name and so forth. I'm a servant. I'm a humble servant, a bond slave of Jesus Christ. And you know what a slave is? A slave is one who does exactly what his master says. He's not there because he's traded slave owners, you know. When you get saved, you don't trade the slave owner of sin and the slave to the slave owner of Jesus Christ. No. When you believe, you leave the bondage of sin and you go into liberty. Liberty. You're not made a slave of Jesus Christ. That's not a part of salvation. You understand that? He doesn't say, if you come to Jesus, you believe on him, and if you promise to do this and this and this and whatever you do, you make all kinds of promises, or you have to be willing to do all these things, and then God will save you. That's not what it is at all. You are in bondage of sin. You were in dead in your trespasses and sins, Ephesians chapter 2, verse 1. You, he has saved and delivered from that bondage into a spiritual liberty. You are not anybody's slave until Romans 12, 1 and 2. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God. Notice it's brethren. I beseech you, brethren, who've been freed and now you have that liberty. I beseech you to present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable unto God, which is your logical service. And stop being conformed to this world, but go on being transformed by the renewing of your mind that you may know what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. That's how you find out the will of God. I am free. I can do as I please. But I decide, and I want to give myself as a slave of Jesus Christ. I served sin long enough. Now I'm going to serve Jesus Christ. And I'm going to serve him totally. That's what this book is about. A bond slave of Jesus Christ, doing what he says. And then, not only of God the Father, but also of Jesus Christ. He's a slave. And he's writing to the 12 tribes. I like that. 12 tribes. It's not two tribes. There are 12 of them. And they're still around. It's not, we lost 10 of them. We didn't lose 10. They're still here, 12. There are 12 here. There are 12 in Acts 27 when Paul talks about them. And there are 12 of them when you get the book of Revelation. When Jesus comes, there are 12 tribes. Right? They didn't lose anything. So they are the 12 tribes who are scattered abroad now, and they're getting this letter from James. Again, a practical letter. I know where you are. I know the problems you're having, and here's what you ought to do about them. Very good. And then the last word, greetings. This is an early term. Paul never uses greeting like this. He uses a similar word, a cognate, but just says grace. But this word is a greeting, which means be happy, be joyful. That's James' word. But again, very early. And very formal. So, in the next few months, let's brace ourselves. We're going to get some really sound advice, really needed advice. And in the process, let's heed what James says. Don't be hearers of the word only, but be doers of that word.